Pastor Wolfmuller here for another conversation with Dr. Gregory Schulz, a professor of philosophy and writer of this book that we're talking about. This is this first mission briefing, the first briefing he has of four in his book on the fellowship of his suffering. He's arguing that the church has failed to teach the biblical doctrine of suffering. The result is the culture of death on demand. And we talked about then the architecture of that culture of death on demand, beginning with Nietzsche and his myth of the madman and the Übermensch, and how that shows up in the founders of death on demand, especially the argument for euthanasia and what that looks like and what we can do about it, how we as Christians counter it with a true anthropology that centers on the incarnation of Jesus. I think you'll be, I was fascinated with this conversation. I really loved it. I learned a lot in it, and I hope you do as well. As always, questions can be below in the comments. I hope you'll do that as well. And I'll come back here at the end for a couple of announcements, but I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Schulz. All right, Dr. Schulz, back for more conversation on, especially on this book, Four Mission Briefings, Facing the Insurgency of Death on Demand, how the church and pastors can sort of understand the terrain of the culture that we are dealing with now and how to face it. We've been, the last couple of conversations, we talked about what it is that man is a sufferer. And even before that, we were talking about the limits of science and how science presents to us this idea of salvation through a future utopia, but how it has no, in fact, authority or capacity to do so. But I wanted to dig into the text now of the mission briefing, and especially the first mission briefing. And I think I want to take it backwards from the order that you've given to us. And what you're doing in this first mission briefing, I think, is giving the underlying history and context of death on demand. How did we get here? Or what things are true such that this can be the reality that we're facing now of a culture that's simply given into death on demand, especially in the forms of abortion, euthanasia, and whatever's coming next, that's just creeping in from the edge. Is that a fair summary, but to get it started?
Well, thanks, Brian. Your summations are always pretty intriguing. I suppose you could also think about this as the architecture of death on demand. And there's lurking in the background a pretty pushy notion of culture, which I mentioned I've learned from Roger Scruton fundamentally, and that's shared moral judgments passed from one generation to the next. In our Western culture would be that, to be a culture, but it's also formed by Greek forms of thinking and the Judeo-Christian scriptures. So, you know, what we're looking at is a kind of, I suppose, anti-architecture when you get down to it, but the effort to take away the foundations and still have the superstructure, sort of.
The philosopher zero, you call him, who sort of laid the foundation. I mean, I suppose the devil is always, he's the prime architect of all of this nonsense, but where it comes to a kind of clarifying point for us is Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, and especially his myth of the madman. And you end the chapter with this, but I'd love to begin the chapter with this, if that's all right. And maybe would you like to read a little bit of it? I'll share the screen and even perhaps to comment as you go on the parable of the madman. And if you want to give an introduction to Nietzsche and his background, I think that would also be great.
Okay, well, thanks. Do you know, I almost want to give a shameless plug for our popular series at whatdoesthismean.org on master metaphors for philosophy. But to give our listeners something a little bit different and yet solid and textual to look at, Nietzsche's story of the madman shows up in his writing, which is generally titled in English, The Gay Science. Now, it's actually Freilich Wissenschaften in his Deutsch, in his German. So it's kind of I think a good paraphrase might be the liberating kind of knowledge. Now, I'd recommend that we understand Nietzsche's madman as a diagnosis of Western culture. And then I also respect and love your notion that it has also become a modern myth by which we steer or try to infuse a kind of meaningfulness into what's going on in Western culture. But I'm just going to think about this.
It could be an anti-myth. I mean, it's wrecking meaning, right? It's tearing down the things that were there. Well, that's kind of a small point, but I think that's it's very interesting that it's not it's handing us over to death. Well, okay, we'll see that. I think
I hear a wonderful another Wolf Miller sermon series coming out of it, personally, from which I may borrow copiously. But, if we and our listeners think first of this as a diagnosis of what we've been doing to ourselves in Western culture, and then back into the longer discussion of that, things could work that way. So anyhow, here is the story. And I appreciated your invitation to offer color commentary along the way, but I know that I kind of go off the deep end in explaining too many of the details in here. So I'm gonna resolve to try to go all the way through it and let it stand pretty much by itself. And then you just prod me a little bit at the end if you want me to elaborate.
That sounds
good. So I'd recommend that we think here about the setting. So it's a village marketplace. For me, near where my home and my university are, one of our bigger shopping centers is Mayfair Mall. It has a clear story kind of structure to it. And that means that in the early morning hours, which is the time frame for Nietzsche's story of the madman, there actually would be sunlight pouring in, and that's kind of important to catch at the moment. But his madman, and you know, we want to do a quick literary reference here. What's the difference between a madman and a prophet? And the answer in literature may be there's no difference at all. One person's madman is another person's prophet, if you get down to it. So Nietzsche writes it this way, and there are all sorts of very fine translations. My little translation here is bordering on the dynamic paraphrase. So here it comes anyhow. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the town square and shouted resolutely, "I'm looking for God. I'm looking for God." Because most of the other folks standing around were casual atheists, there was a lot of laughing. "Why? Did he get lost? Lost child? Hide and seek? Did we scare him off? On vacation? Emigrated, perhaps?" Oh, they yelled and they laughed. So, you know, bright morning hours. And if you think about yourself being at your favorite mall, I suppose the first thing most of us would do at this point would be dial 911, because this fellow sounds like he needs some serious mental health attention. But the folks responding to Nietzsche's prophetic madman are ridiculing him. One sidebar here, this sounds very familiar to you and me and to most of us listening, I suppose. It's an inversion of Elijah and the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel. So back in First Kings, we find Elijah setting up that empirical experiment. You priests of Baal build an altar. I, as a prophet of the Lord, will build an altar. We'll each pray to our respective gods. And obviously, whichever God ignites the sacrifice is the true God. In the case of that historical biblical episode, though, Elijah is the one who's doing the mocking of the priests of Baal. You know, maybe you guys aren't praying loud enough. Maybe the old guy is sound asleep in his rocking chair, right? But here it's put to mocking the person who's looking for the God of the Bible. Then the madman transfixed them with his laser-like stares. Where did he go? All right, let me tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are God's murderers. How have we done this, you're beginning to wonder? How were we able to make the sea evaporate? Who came up with the means to obliterate the horizon of our planet? How did we manage to untether the earth from its sun? Where is it careening off to right now? Where are we headed? To a reality with no suns at all? Look, We are in perpetual free fall, backward, sideward, forward, a non-directional free fall, absolutely no point of orientation. Do you seriously imagine that there is any up or down anymore? Still don't get it? We are adrift aimlessly through an infinite nothing. You do feel it, don't you? A frozen breath of empty space, the absolute coldness of maximum entropy. It is black, starless night. It is night with nothing more light than nightless light, let nothing more but lightless night to follow. We are at the point that lanterns have to be lit in the morning hours too. Listen, don't you hear the rumblings and shovelings of the grave diggers who are burying God? Don't you smell the stench of God's decomposition? God's too decompose. God is dead. God remains dead. Moreover, we have killed him. Think it through. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? What was holiest and most powerful of all the world could ever know has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What baptism is there for us to wash ourselves clean? What holidays of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Are not the consequences of the deed too overwhelming for us? Must we not become gods ourselves simply to live up to it? At this point, the madman fell silent and glared at his listeners. They too fell silent and stared at him in slack-jawed astonishment. After a while, he slammed his lantern on the ground and it broke, its light overcome by the darkness. "I'm a man before my time," he prophesied. "My time has not come quite yet." It's well known that on that same day, the madman ran into one church after another, singing his "Rest in Peace" lamentation for the eternal God. When taken into custody and asked to explain himself, he was widely reported to have said again and again, "What are these churches, really? They're nothing but tombs and static monuments of God." But some very powerful writing. I mean, like it or not, Nietzsche is just an extraordinarily powerful writer. I've referred to him in one of my books as the Pied Piper of Western thought. Now, Nietzsche, as I suggest, is explaining what he sees as good as already accomplished in Western culture, and that's the death of God. It's really worth noting that he's not talking at all in the mode that he's saying God never existed. He was just a myth, but he's saying we got rid of him. Or we got rid of him, but now here comes the genius part and the honesty in Nietzsche. Now we're going to have to deal with this. So where do you go for meaning? We're completely disoriented. What are we going to have to do to make up for this? And that's, of course, something that the easy breezy casual atheist generally hasn't thought about and usually isn't held accountable for, but certainly they should be, right?
This picture of the globe being tethered to the sun like gravity, and now we've cut the chain and we're flying off into empty space, and it's haunting. He says, "Don't you feel it?"